Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlighten Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenradio.org. This is Fanny Crawford.
And Stash Ziolkowski.
We're your storytelling co-hosts for the duration. Today is December 9th, 2019. Our theme today is holiday traditions, and we have a lot to talk about.
Wow, I love it. The opening is better than ever.
Well, starting with Andy Alfred Irwin singing his original composition, Tarry Here. And thank you, Andy, for letting us use that as our opening. So when you said our you meant my introduction,
the
my
introduction
little 20
was
words.
Wonderful.
Okay, whatever.
It was confident.
Okay.
There was not the
I knew what day it was.
I know, the wonderment sometimes in your
the
eyes.
The day is April. Yeah. Well, speaking of wonderment, I wanted to make sure we talk about Saturday night. See, I still don't know what day it is. And your wonderful performance at Susan Gordon's house for her holiday storytelling event.
Okay. Go ahead and talk about it. You got to talk
about it. It was wonderful.
I really appreciate
it. I think you did three stories.
I did.
Including Jonathan Toomey, one of my very favorite stories of all time.
I was really pleased with the audience was wonderful. Susan mentioned in that email that it was like family almost.
It was.
And it was very very nice to be able to tell stories to people who as soon as people started coming down to the room, I recognized everyone's face. Except for I didn't recognize Susan's nephew.
Oh, he was there for when I did TH.
I thought I had seen him before, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, he was there with his parents.
But, you know, almost every face there was a face I know as a serious listener.
Yes.
Somebody who enjoys stories. And one of the things I've said to people a lot is the best thing for a storyteller is to have people who want to listen to stories, because an audience like that wants you to do good.
Yeah.
They want to hear a good storyteller. And most of the time, even if you as the teller will be critical, as I know you are at times, I mean, of yourself,
oh.
You know, when you tell.
Okay.
And I am too, but those people will give you every break. You know, if you think you made a mistake or something, you won't get penalized for it by mean looks or something.
Well, I think most of the people there find those little glitches charming.
Absolutely.
Because they get the inside joke. Yeah. So, for example, you're talking about some kind of baked goods that ended up being molasses cookies with some poaching. that was a hoot. I loved it.
My wife and I wondered about that later. If anyone thought I did that on purpose to include my wife in the program, and she said, no, that would be silly. And I said, well, you never know. But
I enjoyed
it. I truly enjoyed that. And I all the way home and even till I fell asleep that night, I kept thinking this was one of the most enjoyable, maybe the best storytelling evening I've ever had, as far as feeling good about it.
That's wonderful.
That's nice.
Well, and then we had a special bonus from Susan herself telling Richard Kennedy's story.
And if it comes up sometime in the year, I'm going to suggest to her that we do it again that way. If she would, because she likes tradition. she likes doing something at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased that she was going, that she wanted to tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because I think she's a fine storyteller.
Well, and those, and the stories that you each chose really fit together well, very well. Okay. Well, that was fun.
So, well, thank you for giving me a chance to say something about that. That performance was, I've already noted that as one of the highlights of my life.
Very good. I'm thrilled.
Good.
Okay. Now, this is the time in the program when you usually talk about the Speak Story series, but I just wanted to ask if you have any more information about season 8.
Season
coming
eight.
Up.
The information I have is this. On December 11th, which is 2 days hence. Does that make sense? 2 days hence?
Yes.
Good. Wow. I'll be at a meeting with Adam, and I know everybody there, it's a small group, but it is meeting. Everybody there will be dying to know who is the guest storyteller for January 12th, our fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam will not tell us, I know. So, it has gotten, people have gotten really excited about that, that, you know, that we have this mystery guest at our fundraiser on January 12th. And last year it was Jim May, and Jim did a fine job, and people really enjoyed it. And this year, Adam has been very tight-lipped about it. Not even a suggestion about what general area of the country the person might come from. So I'm looking forward to that. And in January, we'll be selling tickets for the
season tickets,
season passes. And we did really well at that last year. I'm hoping we can top the fundraising this year because it has really benefited the tellers that are brought to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the last 4 months, we did a new thing of going to the farmer's market the Sunday before.
Mm-hmm.
The performance on Tuesday evening, and that has helped. It's hard to tell, but that seems to have helped the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And the last August, September, October, and November, I believe, were the 4 biggest months that Speak has had as far as attendance in 1 4-month period.
Mm. Because yeah, well, the room was full or almost full.
Right, and that, that's a lot better than since I've been going to Speak, which has been 2 years and 6 months or something like that. I couldn't remember even 3 months in a row where the room was almost full.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. We have had good audiences every month, but not that volume.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful because that means more and more people are getting to know what's good about storytelling.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping that there's so many season tickets sold that there'll be standing room only at some point.
Well, that's good. That would be great.
And the date for the fundraiser in January with the surprise guest teller is?
January 12th at 4 in the afternoon.
Oh, I didn't know the 4 p.m.
From 4 to 6 at the community club.
All right.
In Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
I will be there.
Good. And there is going to be an auction.
Oh, like last year.
Not exactly like last year. That's one of the things I hope to find out on Wednesday. The only thing I know for sure is that a performance by Adam Booth and Sheila Arnold is one of the auction things that will be auctioned off in last year.
For a house concert.
A house concert. So
big deal. Okay.
That will be wonderful.
All right. Then, if we are finished with that little bit of business,
yes.
Then I'm going to suggest that one of us tell a story. And it should probably be you, because you probably have 2 stories, and I have only one.
Okay.
So.
I just want to mention something about the time here. We're already 8 minutes and 30 seconds into the program.
Yes, I would agree with that.
So, and listeners, that doesn't thrill any of you at all, but it does to us. We keep trying to keep track of the time. I just found something incredible on this desk.
A steampunk pen.
And it's a dragon.
Okay.
Okay, before we begin, tell me what steampunk really means. Because I keep seeing that occasionally and I have no idea.
I'm not the right person. But I understand it as a celebration of technology and industry from the late 19th century into the early 20th. So gadgets and gears and old-fashioned clothing.
Right.
And a little bit of wackiness and an appreciation for science fiction, especially old-fashioned science fiction. Yes. It's just an opportunity for people to get silly and wear costumes.
Well, all right.
Try out at outlandish devices.
Right. Okay, that starts to make sense in my brain then.
So steam power
is
the focus, it goes off in all kinds of directions from there.
And
but really, I'm not somebody. We'll have somebody call into the show tell me I'm full of it.
That's okay. Well, okay.
We could have a steampunk theme sometime.
That means studying.
Yes, it would mean studying for both of us.
Well, I just finished reading a wonderful, long story written by Jules Verne in 1865 that might
fit
absolutely. Sort of that.
Yeah.
It's two books in From the Earth to the Moon.
Mm-hmm. I've read From the Earth to the Moon.
And the second book is And the Trip Around It.
I haven't read that one.
I was fascinated by it because it was completely different from what I thought it might be. And it had a lot of good science in it, and it had a lot of great math, and which I always appreciate. But also it had real fantastic...
real fantastic...
description of the backside of the moon from two different characters. There were three main characters, but two of the characters in the space projectile describing the moon in the backside, which human beings never see. And
is it the same three characters who were in From the Earth to the Moon?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking.
And yes, and I was fascinated because they thought they were going to land on the moon, which really got my attention. Landing on the moon, they thought, was going to be relatively easy. And anyway, it was exciting. It was an exciting
book. So is that the story you're going to tell today for holiday traditions? No.
No, it would take many hours. It took me a long time to read that book. Okay. So, the first thing I would like, this is a short thing, about the tyranny of holiday traditions.
Indeed.
I don't know if you have any tyrannical holiday traditions, but I have experienced some.
I did at one time.
Okay, and I will not mention anyone's name in this, but I was involved with a certain... small group of people of various ages, and the holiday traditions were truly tyrannical in my mind, so much so that I was not allowed to touch the Christmas tree, or I wasn't able to satisfy some person's design criteria. And it was suggested to me that I just sit and watch as the tree was decorated. And my function in that effort was to make sure the tree was straight and adjusted properly into the corner and that it wouldn't fall down, all kind of those things, which have nothing to do with decorating a Christmas tree. That's more like building something in a corner, a bookcase or something. And it was my first wife who had definite ideas about where everything should go, and absolutely refused the idea of throwing tinsel onto the tree. I don't know if you ever used tinsel in your trees.
Yes, but we always had tinsel in right, my childhood and trees. Yes.
As a child, I remember that being one of the thrills. I know that afterwards my mother went around and fixed it, you know, but...
So you were used to pushy women telling you that you're, or acting as if your efforts were substandard.
Yeah, there you go. That's the yeah, so, right, yeah. I had a counselor tell me once, you married your mother. That was I told him that's a terrible thing to say. But at least in some ways.
I had a psychologist. I'm interrupting your story.
I had
a psychologist, a teacher at Hood College, tell the class that everyone marries their mother as their first marriage. Some people make that work, but... Right. Most people in this country don't make that work. And even women end up marrying their mothers the first time.
Their mothers?
Yes. And that I could even at that point in my life, I could see the veracity of that claim.
Wow. I would think that they would suggest that women marry their fathers.
That may eventually happen. But right. His proposal, his thesis, was yeah. that the first time around.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
On that note.
That night. Okay, but, at the beginning of the reign of tyranny, actually happened my senior year in college. And when we went out into the woods to cut down a tree to decorate for Christmas. And we selected a tree. There were a number of us. There were three younger siblings, and there was myself and my future wife. And we cut down a tree, and when we pulled it out of its home where it had lived in this little bit of a forest and stood it up, it was vetoed. It was decided it wasn't good enough. And that evening has never left my mind whenever I think about Christmas trees, because we killed a tree for no good reason, only for the fact that someone didn't think it was pretty enough. And it felt like I was part of an execution. I never expressed that to any of them, because they were so happy with the next one that we cut down. And that's never gone away from my brain, that, you know, here we cut down a tree. In fact, that is, there is a long tale that I've written and that I've done in drama in two different schools, and in for public performance as a puppet show about trees, and especially about trimming trees as decorating them for Christmas, based on that fact that I hate the idea of cutting a tree down. And I never even thought of it when I was young. And I know my father went out and bought a tree, and I know, I know that tree was sold to my father, and somebody cut it down, and but I never thought of that as a young person. And something about cutting a tree down and then discarding it, just throwing it on the side, seemed to be ultimately wrong. And there are lots of things I do that are not good for nature, that I've done that are just as destructive, probably, not on purpose. You know, if I know something is wrong, you shouldn't do it. I try hard not to do that. But that always stuck with me. And so the story I wrote about the Tree of Cathar became a model lesson that I've used about, you know, don't kill things and take care of nature and stuff. You have a surprised look on your face.
No, that's not a surprised look. That's a, well, I don't feel surprised. Let me just, I don't know what kind of looks on my okay. face, but I don't feel surprised. I feel I'm keeping myself from chiming in and adding to your story because I have similar experiences.
It's a good thing, yeah. So anyway, the other, to follow along with my story of tyranny here, there are places... especially one in Baltimore, where you can go in a community, and I won't try to remember the name of the community because I'll probably get it wrong. But for a number of years, we used to pile into the car, both adults and children, and especially not young children, because they loved it. They didn't find anything odd about the experience because the lights were so bright. But there is a stretch in Baltimore that goes from in the city, leads out to the suburbs in this one area that for about a good 3/4 mile to a mile, the houses on both sides of the street are decorated in the most outrageous fashion. With, you know, if someone had the idea that 500 lights would look good on the porch, they... figured 5,000 will look even better. And some of the homes are make a real effort to make it look holiday-like and Christmas-like. And lots of their neighbors just make an effort to look it as colorful and bright and lit up as possible. So that if you were to go even a mile away from that neighborhood, stood on a tall building, you could see the glow of red, green, blue, yellow, orange bulbs. So, and that's only one of the places that I know does that. On vacations over the years, my wife and I have gone around Christmas time, and we've actually paid and gotten in line to drive a certain part of the place we were visiting, that area, because they have Christmas decorations. Themes of all kind of Christmas Christmas celebrations and, you know, stories and things like that. And the last time we did that was maybe 20 years ago, 21 years ago, something like that. And I'm glad we don't do that anymore because it's just not worth it in my mind. And recently I ran afoul of someone's love of a lit up thing at this time of the year. When we moved to this area almost 3 years ago now, in 2017, the first Christmas that we were here, we were told that there would be luminaries placed throughout the battlefield at Antietam. 23,000 luminaries.
Every year.
Every year. And so we thought, oh, that's interesting. You can drive through. There's a path that they guide you through, and you can, you know. We thought about doing that, but... we heard that there's a big crowd, and so we thought, well, it starts at dusk. It was about 5:30 or 6 o'clock, and certainly if we wait until 10 or 10:30, then we can just go out and drive through the grounds. Well, it turns out that starting at about, this is no exaggeration, starting at about 3 in the afternoon, cars begin to line up on, I think the route is 32.
34.
34, between Boonesboro and Sharpsburg and Shepherdstown, straight line there. People begin to line up behind a barrier that the police have placed, and there will be police cars on both sides of the road directing traffic. And so there will be hundreds and hundreds of cars lined up. It's cold outside with their motor running. And it's dark, so they have their lights on also. Saturday night, when we drove past this arrangement on our way to Frederick, I clocked three. I paid attention to the odometer. 3.1 miles of cars. Okay. That was at 5:30 in the evening. They hadn't opened the gates yet. We came home and passed that point at 10 o'clock. And there was still 2.3 miles of. And I know that they weren't the same cars.
Yeah, every year.
Starting at 6. So I've asked a couple of people to explain to me why that is such an attraction. For me, the first year, anything new in our area where we lived, I'd like to know what's going on, see it. But I have no desire to do that. And I won't do that because I think of the fumes, vapors, and the cost of all that gasoline being burned. And I don't mean the cost of the gasoline, the cost to the environment.
Yeah.
But it's this, and in my mind, it's the same thing as it's just the pretty lights that attract people. I did ask one person about this who I thought was really up on the area. They've lived here a long time. And said, so why, what's the big deal with 23,000 lights? And I
you
know
the
number.
Answer, yeah.
It was to celebrate and remember the casualties of a one-day battle during the Civil War. And I said, that's interesting. That includes celebrating the life of the casualties on both sides. If they 23,000 included
sure. mm-hmm.
the northern and the southern soldiers. And I said, oh, that seems like a strange thing for the people here to do. And he said, why? That's the number is very well known. I said, yeah, but this. The Confederate soldiers were dug up and shipped off to Hagerstown or someplace else. There are no Confederates buried in
right
near that.
So far as we know.
Yeah. And only if it would be in an accident, you know, unknown. And he thought that I was really strange that I would want to consider honoring the Confederates by burying them next to the Northern troops. And so our conversation ended rather abruptly with him turning away from me and walking off. I didn't hear muttering, but I could imagine him muttering crazy liberal or something, you know. Anyway, so I would never want to stop anybody from being a part of that if they thought it was worthwhile, but I won't do it. And I wouldn't encourage anybody else to do it.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings because... is it okay for me to talk now?
Exactly. Of course. We're a team.
Well, you were telling a story.
That's okay.
Or recounting your experience. And I have I'm ambivalent about all of that. The same thing, I have similar feelings about the battlefield events around July 4th because they're fireworks and the Maryland Symphony plays.
Right.
But it's so many people that there's no way I can go. I just don't have the patience to sit and wait all that time and to be with that number of people. But it is interesting what people want to celebrate.
Okay. Well, I'm finished with tyranny.
Okay. So if I tell a happier story.
Yes.
Now, okay. Well, let me preface this by talking about stories in the round. December 23rd will be the final session of season six. And I am the featured storyteller that evening at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church, 13245 Searfoss Pike. At 7 p.m., $10 in advance, $12 at the door. I think I have a plan for what I'm going to tell. I'm not talking about it much so far, except to say that I think, you cannot hold me to this, but I think that T.H. Barnes will be there to open the show and then and tell a brief story or two, and then there will be other topics, other stories.
Okay.
Happening.
I'm excited. I expect this will be the best stories in the round session of the year.
We'll see about that. Okay, and if anybody wants more information, 301-730-1638, or my email address is fanitsky, F-A-N-I-T-S-K-Y, at hotmail.com. So, my story today is on the theme, as yours was, of holiday traditions. I'm not going to talk about the tyranny of holiday traditions, but I'm guessing there was some tyranny in here somewhere. My dad came from a family that did a lot of cooking, and he did work for a bit in the family catering business when he was young, and when my brother Dougie and I were kids growing up in Philadelphia, my dad was the primary cook for our family, and he cooked professionally in several big storied institutions. I do remember some stories from that period at the Methodist Children's Home and at Lankenau Hospital. Those are the two main places that I remember from my childhood. Now, I guess because of my dad's stories about cooking, I was interested in cooking early on. But I think my interest in learning about other people's food traditions started with Thanksgiving preparations when I was 8 or 9 years old. And we lived in West Philly on Parkside Avenue in the 5-room first floor rear apartment of a row house across the street from Fairmount Park, not far from the Philadelphia Zoo. And I'd gone with my dad on Saturday before Thanksgiving to the A&P grocery store that was near our house to pick out the turkey and buy the sweet potatoes and fresh oranges to make candied yams and the lima beans and corn and red peppers for the succotash and almonds and fresh green beans for the green bean almondine. Now, on a regular basis, the dark brown German pumpernickel or the rye bread that we ate every day at home came from Goldman's Bakery, which was just around the corner on 41st Street. So at the A&P, it was a big deal that Saturday to buy that long loaf of prepackaged Pepperidge Farm bread that Daddy said I would help cut into cubes along with the celery and the mushrooms for the turkey stuffing. And we also bought ingredients for my mother's contribution to the feast, which would be two pies, an apple pie and a mincemeat pie. Now, besides all of that shopping, there was also a mysterious bag of secret ingredients that Daddy carried into the house. And I had no idea what was in that bag. He must have collected those groceries when I was busy choosing the sweet potatoes, or maybe when I was locked in at the A&P coffee grinder there in the corner of the store, where I was smelling all the wonderful coffee smells at the big black and red coffee grinder, where my parents sometimes got their coffee ground fresh and packed into those little bags. But that was just for special occasions. Anyway, Daddy said that that big brown A&P bag of groceries would be a surprise after Thanksgiving dinner. But I could not imagine what he could be talking about, because I already knew what we were having. We were having pie for dessert, so he wasn't talking about dessert. So now at school all that week, we'd been talking about pilgrims and singing Thanksgiving songs for days and days. And my elementary school, Joseph Leidy School, after the famous Philadelphia scientist, was built in 1898. So there was no cafeteria in our school. And we all went home at lunchtime from 12 to 1. But my parents both had outside employment every day. So I would walk with my friend Paula to her house for lunch. Paula and her three sisters lived with their parents on the second and third floor of an old rambling row house with a big front porch. And Paula's Bubby and Pop-Pop and her aunt, Tanta, her great aunt, lived on the first floor. And that was the floor with the main kitchen. Now, Paula's mom cooked lunch for us. Things like hot dogs and Chef Boyardee spaghetti and Campbell's soup every day for lunch, which I thought was just delicious because we didn't have any of that stuff at my house. And we always, every day, we had something like Tasty Cakes or Hostess Donuts for dessert. So it was fine with me to have lunch at my friend Paula's house. And I always made a big point of explaining to my parents the real food, the best food that we had at Paula's house, and trying to convince them that we should buy some of those things at the A&P, but that never happened. Now, for holidays at Paula's house, for Passover or for Rosh Hashanah or for Thanksgiving, Bubby was the cook. And that year, which is, so I guess this was Wednesday before Turkey Day, when we arrived for lunch, the whole house smelled of chicken soup. And to be specific, kreplach soup, which kreplach is sort of like ravioli, but it's so it's handmade noodles stuffed, in this case, was stuffed with chicken liver and eggs. And it had this a thick yellow schmaltz, chicken fat, on top. It was just wonderful. I loved this soup. I mean, I had it there, not regularly, but often enough at Paula's house that I knew that I loved kreplach soup. It was delicious. And there were big chunks of carrots and other vegetables in the soup, too. Now, this is the point where I'm going to take the opportunity to add this little non sequitur to the story, which is my dad cooked with both chicken fat and bacon. So when he made, we had roast chicken at least once a week at home, sometimes more than once a week. And my dad always saved all the schmaltz. Now, he knew he didn't call it schmaltz from his childhood, but he knew that it was schmaltz. My mother's Jewish. So the running joke from my dad was to have two cardboard orange juice cans. You know those cardboard cans, yes, and orange juice, mm-hmm, frozen orange juice comes in. Well, they used to come in the small size. So these were like, mm-hmm, 4-inch tall little cans, and one can would be full of bacon fat and one can would be full of schmaltz. And my dad found that hysterically funny that you would have schmaltz and bacon fat on the same stove, on the same counter in a single house. And he talked about that whenever there were visitors and people would peer into those cans, he would tell them all about schmaltz and bacon fat. Anyway, but at Paula's house, Bubby gave us each a big bowl of kreplach soup. She gave us hunks of challah bread because she was making challah for the holiday. And these big dill-pickled green tomatoes that she had grown herself over the summer and preserved in these huge half-gallon mason jars. And there were still a few half-gallon jars of pickled tomatoes in her pantry that she had saved for just this occasion. Now, for the next day, for Thanksgiving, she would serve kreplach soup and challah and pickled tomatoes. But the main dish, the entree, would be roast duck. And she had the ducks already in her enamel roasting pan sitting over on the side. And she made us come over and look at these beautiful ducks these naked ducks marinating. They were trussed up with twine and marinating in some kind of spicy brine. Now, I didn't much like looking at those naked ducks, but I did peek at them because she wanted us to see how wonderful they were. I'd been once or twice with my parents to the neighborhood slaughterhouse where ducks and chickens and turkeys were kept in wooden cages and killed and plucked on demand for customers. So I knew all about that smelly, bloody place, full, like ankle deep in white feathers. And it smelled awful in that place. So I pretty much managed to banish that place from my memory after those one or two visits when I was very young. And I think actually the slaughterhouse disappeared very soon. By the time I was 10, it was long gone. Now, Bubby didn't speak English, only Yiddish and Polish. So she communicated with me by pats on the head, smiling, and hand gestures. And she loved to save the choicest bits of whatever it was she was making for us girls. And I loved eating this stuff. So I was very fond of her, in spite of those dead naked ducks. Now, walking back to school at 1 o'clock, I started thinking, could Daddy's mystery bag of groceries on Saturday that he had talked about, could that be related to roast duck or creplock soup? It didn't seem very likely because I knew what the Thanksgiving menu was in our house. But, you know, maybe it could be. And back at school that afternoon, we had more obligatory songs and stories about the first Thanksgiving. But, you know, those stories didn't make nearly as great an impression on me as my experiences with all this food and table talk about Thanksgiving. Our family vacations in rural western New York, visiting my dad's extended family, my aunts and my uncles and my cousins, usually included, I hear a train. Do you hear a train?
Yes.
I wonder if our listeners can hear a train. Okay. Usually included visits to the town of Salamanca, New York, and the Seneca Iroquois Reservation for cultural events. We didn't go every single year to the reservation, but whenever there was a special event held at the same time that we were there, my dad would take us because he had all these fond memories of people and places that he remembered from his childhood and the reservation there, and he wanted to share that with us. So the stories that I heard at school and repeated to my dad about Squanto of the Wampanoag, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. It's been a long time since I've talked about Wampanoag Indians. But those stories about them, about Squanto in particular, showing the pilgrims how to plant corn and saving all these lives, my dad invariably would snort and shake his head. And he never said anything more than that. So I didn't know why he didn't believe or buy into those stories. I was really a grown-up before I began to figure out what all that cognitive dissonance was about in those conversations. But walking home from school that afternoon, I met up with my friend Peaches. Her real name was Lillian, but all us kids called her Peaches because that's what her mom called her, who lived just down the street from us. Now, Peaches was a couple years older than me, and she went to a different school. She went to Our Mother of Sorrows Catholic School, which was not too far away from our house. But she was a favorite playmate of mine for street games on weekends and in the summertime. And just then, she was on her way home from the corner store because her mother had sent her from a few last-minute Thanksgiving ingredients. So we walked the last block together, and then Peaches invited me into her house because she had just gotten this new, beautiful, grown-up navy blue dress with a jacket, this kind of very elegant ensemble, and she was going to wear that to her grandma's house for Thanksgiving, and she was very proud of it. She wanted somebody to see it, and I was the only kid around, so I would have to do. And she tried it on, and she was just elegant in it. And I always thought of her as a very beautiful girl. And I had never had a dress, anything like that. Suit was really a suit. But in the meantime, her mom was cooking chitlins and greens, and a big ham to take to Peach's grandma's house for Thanksgiving the next day. And the aromas, especially the chitlins, were new and almost overpowering to me. I had never smelled chitlins in my memory that I remembered at that point. And Peaches made me taste a spoonful of chitlins and a spoonful of greens. I knew all about ham, and the ham wasn't ready yet anyway. But and I had no idea what chitlins were, but they tasted much better than they smelled. So I was happy to have tried them. And when I left Peaches' house, I was thinking again about that mysterious A&P brown paper bag and what was in that bag. Maybe it was full of chitlins and greens. I mean, I didn't know what my dad was planning as this special surprise. It was just weird. Why would we be eating, we wouldn't be eating chitlins and greens after Thanksgiving dinner. So it just didn't make sense. And at supper that night, I told two Thanksgiving food preparation stories to my family about the chitlins and the greens and the ham from Peach's house, and then the kreplach and the ducks and the pickled tomatoes that Bubby was making. And Daddy said he'd be getting up early to make our Thanksgiving dinner and reminded me that I was going to help. Well, he was up by 6 a.m. to cook the turkey. And I got up later, but I did my part. I helped with the stuffing, and I got Dougie, my little brother, to help me set the table. And dinner itself was all I'd imagined it would be. Though I did wonder out loud about what duck and kreplach soup or chitlins and ham might have added to the festivities. But anyway, we didn't finish our Thanksgiving meal till after dark. And then there was all that cleaning up to do. But I kept asking my dad about the surprise that he'd promised from the A&P bag. And he kept putting me off. He said there might not be time for that now, that the surprise was really for Friday after Thanksgiving. He had never intended that it was going to be right after dinner. And I was disappointed, but I was tired too. It had been a long day. The next morning, the Friday after Thanksgiving, Daddy was up again very early. And since I was consumed with the question of the mysterious A&P bag, I was up pretty early too. And I discovered that the surprise was a whole new cooking project. We were going to make Daddy's family recipe. Well, really great grandma Mary Bell's recipe, his grandma's recipe for Christmas fruitcake. So inside the brown paper bag was 10 pounds of flour, 5 pounds of sugar, 3 pounds of butter, molasses, walnuts that had to be cracked and picked, oranges and lemons to be made into citron and candied orange peel, fresh pineapple and cranberries. And it took us most of that day to prepare the ingredients and get the pans ready. My dad used 6-inch wide by 4-inch tall Maxwell House coffee cans. Do you remember those cans that opened with a key? Yes, all around the outside. Well, he had been saving those cans all year. He had 18 of them, and that's all he used them for, was just for those cakes. And while he was getting the cans ready and doing the stuff with the fruit, it was my job to crush the walnuts with a rolling pin and get all the flour sifted before he would measure it out. And then the next day, it took us a long time to get all that first part done. So the next day was the actual baking day. And that day, it was my job to beat the eggs, to cream the butter with the sugar, and lick all the bowls. And I took my job very seriously, of course. We finished baking 3 batches of cakes in those coffee cans, 18 cakes in all. And then Daddy soaked them in brandy and wrapped them in wax paper, re-scrubbed and rinsed the coffee cans and let them dry for a while. And then he put the cakes all wrapped back into the cans so he could mail them off to friends and family 30 days after they had been soaking. And they would go to all over the United States to my aunts and uncles and my mom's family. And as I watched him finish putting the last of these brandy-soaked cakes into their cans, this great wave of disappointment washed over me. And I remember blurting out, "Daddy, Daddy, kids don't eat brandy. There won't be any cake for me and Dougie." But Daddy just laughed, and he took down two cakes from the top of the refrigerator that he had set aside, and he had me brush those two cakes with orange juice mixed with Baker's orange extract, that was our version of brandy, and wrap them up for us to open just before Christmas. And waiting for the grand opening of the fruitcakes was almost as hard as waiting for Christmas itself, but somehow, with great fortitude and courage, we managed, Dougie and I.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. See, and I love stories that remind me of something that I know in my life. And my wife's, my mother-in-law's husband, Paul McCormick, Dr. Paul McCormick, who was a PhD in electrical engineering.
And, wow.
Who has passed away, but Paul, for years, Paul and Lodi, my mother-in-law, lived in Murrysville, Virginia, in a 55 and over community until he died. In that community, until Paul passed away, none of his neighbors, none of his friends there knew him to be what he truly was. They thought of him as the guy who did the community newsletter and who kept score for the golf league and who baked thousands, and I mean thousands, of cookies every December and gave out wonderful plates full of cookies to his neighbors and friends there, and made the best my mind just went blank on what your
fruitcakes
he made special fruitcakes, and he and I became friends very soon after I met him when I was dating his daughter. And we became such good friends that Paul broke his rule of giving fruitcakes to families by giving two fruitcakes to me and my wife.
Wow.
I was amazed. I wasn't amazed the first time, but when I found out that he usually just gave one fruitcake to a family, I was very impressed. And I looked forward to that fruitcake every year. It was so wonderful. And his cookie operation was phenomenal. They had a separate freezer and a separate refrigerator in their laundry room for Paul's cookies so that he could have a place to put them before the holidays, because it was a massive undertaking and never sold or anything like that. Just gave them to people. And it turned out that until he died, and there was an obituary printed, most people who knew Paul in the last 30 years of his life did not know that he was a member of the team that created the first artificial heart.
Oh.
And that he also had done a lot of wonderful research and teaching at the University of Pennsylvania with his doctorate. So they thought of him as just this wonderful man who also knitted hundreds and hundreds of lap blankets and blankets for newborn children, and gave them to the hospitals, and was written up in the paper for that. Thinking about your father and the cooking and everything reminded me of Paul, who was just the most delightful person and the only person, I think, in this whole world who could have gotten me to sit down and watch ice hockey. And every time we visited, I would sit in a chair next to Paul in his recliner. And if and it was a lot of times it was in the winter time when we visited, and we would watch ice hockey.
Boy, oh boy. And,
it was just a delightful, wonderful human being. I never have gotten over the fact that when he died, I wasn't going to get any more of those fruitcakes.
Well, now you've set me a challenge, because I'm going to have to give you one of my dad's recipe.
That would be great. So, shall I? We have about...
3 minutes.
No, about 6 minutes left. 5 minutes. I would like to say some more about holiday traditions.
We started five minutes.
Five. So okay. If we end on 57.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Okay. Here we go. One of the most fascinating things I learned about the Jewish people have their Christmas week. That's what I call it, Hanukkah. It's at the same time. And usually about every 15 years, Hanukkah and Christmas fall on the exact same day. All the time. But and I thought that was fascinating. And I've known a couple of Jewish men and women, a few of them, who do something really wonderful on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day for their Christian friends.
Mm-hmm.
People who normally would be working on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. And I've met a number of firefighters and policemen who are Jewish. And they always make sure that they sign up to take duty on those days so that their Christian fellows, workers, can have the holiday off.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I heard of that, I thought that was the most wonderful thing a person could do, to take someone else's work mm-hmm. so they could celebrate. Okay, here's a couple things that I'd like to mention. A relatively new thing is ugly sweaters. Jimmy Fallon gives out ugly sweaters for 12 days before his Christmas show, which is really, they have a random thing through the audience. And they really are pretty ugly, but people just love them. They're treasures.
One year
I saw a man who had gotten his sweater about 4 years before that. He goes to Fallon's. He makes sure he has a ticket for Fallon's show at that time of the year so he can wear his ugly sweater in appreciation.
Yeah, some of them have flashing lights on them.
Yes.
They're wild.
And people have favorite stories at Christmas time.
Oh, yeah.
Movies, books. And I thought I would mention some of them. One of my favorites is The Gift of the Magi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mine too.
The Bible story. Luke, about the birth of Christ. Christmas Carol, which is really a favorite of mine, since I performed in that a number of times as Scrooge. Visit from St. Nicholas,
mm-hmm.
and It's a Wonderful Life, and Miracle on 34th Street,
mm-hmm.
and A Christmas Story, which I am not crazy about.
You don't like that one
I'm just not crazy about it. It isn't this.
It's not the same caliber.
It's not, yeah. It's, but it is very popular, and there are people who would not miss it.
Right.
And so, those things. There's lots.
My husband is one of those people.
He would not miss that?
Yeah, we have to see it at least once every year.
Yeah. Well, I've watched it a number of times. It doesn't thrill me as much. One of the big things in my family, Christmas Eve dinner, you had to be there for it
mm-hmm.
until people got married or were out in the world, like in the Navy and stuff. Everybody sat at the table. In my family, there were six of us. We had to eat some bit of every bit of food Mom made. She would have like 12 different dishes. And she purposely, I loved it that she purposely made dishes that some of us didn't like. And it was a great thrill to me to see my oldest brother, Paul, and my sister, Marcella. I would look for their faces when Mom would say, I made that especially for you, too, because they hated this one dish she made. And the other tradition in our family was a poitek.
Yeah.
The wafer, the bread, mm-hmm. the wafer bread. It's real thin, like the communion wafer. And
I only know what it is because I've heard you talk about it.
Well, it's one of the mathematical problems that I've never really finished in my life is the head of the family would get this rectangular wafer and go to the next person in the family, be the wife of his husband, and break off, she would break off a piece, and he would say something, some blessing. And then he would break off a piece of hers, and she would in turn say a blessing. And then she would take that piece that she had broken from his and go to the next person in the family and do the same thing. And then that person would go to the next person in the family, the same thing. And meanwhile, the head of the household, my father, would go down the row to everybody. And so before we ate, everybody is breaking pieces of the opłatek, and some people say opłatki, and sharing it with each other. So the numbers boggle my mind. As a kid, I used to think, you know, how does he know if everybody really did or didn't? And nowadays, I even read, which really drove me crazy, that recently read that there are some places that are making opłatek of certain colors that are designed just for the family pets. That some families actually include their pets in this sacred tradition that was started like hundreds of years ago to honor the Christ child in the Christmas story.
So you don't think Jesus would have shared his last crumbs with the family cat?
I don't think Jesus would have had a family cat.
Well,
but
he probably
just,
didn't.
That's just my own bend, you know. But I'm never too amazed by what people will do
for their pets.
In order to make money.
Okay, all right. We're agreed on that. Okay.
Okay, so, all right. If you're still awake out there, actually, this was fun. This is Stacy Olkowski
and Fanny Crawford.
Closing out the Noontime Radio Storytelling Hour. Community radio in Bolivar, West Virginia.
Where are we?
Bolivar, West Virginia, yes. The Storytelling Hour offers listeners a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand our own stories. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, we have bluegrass.
All the way from
Kentucky.
Actually, from everywhere. Okay, bye.